Okay, good afternoon. So today we're going to talk about hardware control languages. So we're going to go from having pictures to actually being able to sort of program in a sense you can actually test that in the real world we could actually synthesize into circuits the hardware design rather than just draw pictures of how it conceptually works. But first, some logistics. So if you didn't read the schedule, there's an exam next week. So next Tuesday, we'll finish up whatever I don't get to on this topic and do some exam review. And I don't intend to like prepare something fixed for the exam review, so if you want me to review things, you should come with questions. Next Wednesday, the lab is review for the exam. You don't need to come, but that's what we'll do during lab. And in other logistics, some selected anonymous feedback. Could you make the slides available sometime in the morning before lecture? So sometimes the slides are made surprisingly late, which is the main reason I don't do this. But if you click the all notes link at the top of the schedule page, mine are sometimes available before lecture, but often in draft format. So like they might change, but that's there. And Samira, I think, made an effort to do this like right before class, but that may not always happen because we sometimes edit slides really late, especially if we have to change them based on what happened in the previous class or something like that. So there's some question about, we had this quiz question about simpler instructions can take up less space, that being a risk thing. And people were wondering, well, you know, having simpler instructions, that's risk, right? So it's good. But this was pointing out that in our Y86, something like NOP, which is definitely simpler than MRMoveQ, for example, takes up less space because, in part, it's simpler. It has less parameters, less operands. And this is something that RISC-like designs don't do, because that's a variable length encoding, taking up less space in memory for the instruction. Yes?
On average, though, RISC ISAs tend to have, their fixed length instructions tend to be shorter than, on average, CISC instructions, right?
So the question is, on average, RISC ISAs instructions tend to be shorter than CISC ones. So this is probably not true, depending on what you call the average instruction.
Okay.
So for a RISC ISA, if you want to put a constant, for a fixed length instruction encoding, if you want to support putting constants in your instruction, mm-hmm. that's going to basically determine how big your instructions are.
Yeah.
Whereas maybe most of our instructions in a CISC ISA don't have a constant. In that case, they might be an average shorter.
Okay. And
it's usually the case when you have a variable length encoding that programs end up being shorter.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Yes, question?
It's kind of like RISC is more simple in terms of logically, but not necessarily memory-wise.
So the question is, does it mean RISC is more simple logically, but not memory-wise? I think the way to think about it, RISC is about making the hardware implementation simpler.
Hardware, okay.
Pretty much everything else is more complicated. Like the compiler needs to do more work. The assembler needs to do more work because the instructions have a more varied encoding. But the hardware implementation, the assembler doesn't need to do more work, but it might be simpler. But the compiler definitely needs to do more work, or assembler programmers need to do more work in exchange for making the hardware simpler. So RISC is about reducing the hardware, not other things.
The complexity, not like memory.
The complexity of the hardware. Yeah.
Is that why smaller mobile devices tend to be more risk-like because they're trying to take up less space?
So the question is this why mobile devices tend to have more risk-like processors? And part of the reason is, the question is implying that because it takes up less space. So space is probably not the constraint because you can make a really small, these days, it wasn't historically true, you can make a really small CISC processor, but power consumption is likely one of the reasons. As Samira mentioned, if you care about power consumption, the decoding logic you need for the CISC design, even if you have the space for it, it's going to probably use more power. And there was some anonymous feedback about other quiz questions being unclear in ways which don't make us suspect people don't know what the answer is supposed to be, we'll think about it. Also, some feedback that we'd add things to the quiz page late. We are not consistent about when we add quizzes to the quiz page. I will tell you, there is two quizzes per week, or there will always be a quiz for a week listed. If there's not, like next week, we will put a placeholder. So you can always go and see, is there a quiz for this week on the quiz page when the quiz should be out. If there's not a quiz, we will put a quiz which says, like, there is no quiz this week as the name of the quiz, with no questions on it. And we sometimes write the quizzes very late, and the reason why they start at like 5:30 is so after the second lecture we can revise them if something happens, so they don't cover things we didn't cover, which I think you appreciate. Okay. So also a complaint about why do our labs and homeworks have nothing to do with what we're discussing in lecture? So I don't think they have nothing to do, but there is a time delay. And this is a bit of awkwardness in this course, and we'd appreciate suggestions for fixing it in the future. So the biggest issue is that we can't really give you a YD6 assignment yet, because you don't know quite enough to make an interesting assignment. And the early assignments, there's some delay between when we teach them in lecture, like we talked about bit operations earlier, and now we have the assignment, and it's a little hard to sync up and keep everything we want to review. Especially things which are 2150 topics that we aren't spending time on in lecture, but we want to make sure you still know or learn if you didn't learn. We also have this weird scheduling constraint, which is that we didn't want a homework before StringSep, because I think at least retrospectively, many of you will believe you should have spent time preparing for it. And that kind of made our schedule a bit weird, which is why the memory safety lab was where it was, because it didn't have a homework after it. And so that's why the schedule looks the way it was, and yes, I don't think it's great. But it's hard to fix. Yes?
Like a test, can we assume that if like we haven't had to implement it in homeworks, we shouldn't need to implement it?
So the question is, on the test, can we assume if we haven't had it in homework, it's not on the test? No.
As far as like implementation?
As far as implementation. It depends what you call implementation. Right. So you can see what typical tests are from past semesters, and we are certainly going to ask questions about processor implementation things, like maybe not writing HCL to D most likely, but we will ask questions about like the pictures Samira showed you, like where are the muxes, what are those inputs need to be, what instructions need values. Those sorts of questions are likely to be on the test. Okay. Also, on the list homework, which some people didn't like, so this is new this semester. Previously, the first part of that assignment was an in-lab quiz. I don't know if that's better or worse. Certainly saves lab time. There was a bug where sometimes the save button didn't work. This was fixed on Monday, and I apologize for it. I didn't realize it because we checked that we sent something to the server and not that the server actually got it and we didn't get back like a NetBadge login page. It's basically what the bug was. Sorry, I didn't announce it because I don't know what you do with the information that we fixed a bug that already hurt you if it hurt you and otherwise didn't help you. But otherwise there were general complaints that everything was wrong with it. So we generally feel that giving you something where you could submit things to an autograder was a gift, you know, that the sort of default mode for us would be just having you upload a C file to Archimedes and finding out a day later how you did, which would probably have been pretty bad for everyone. But I would be interested in technical improvements I can make. And one thing I do regret is that we probably should have gotten a refresher on pointers to pointers, since apparently that people aren't comfortable with that, and that came up in what was added to this assignment for the append and remove of equal functions. But we don't want to like give out all our test cases, because I know someone's going to write, like, if it's 1, 2, 3, return 1, 2, 3. That's certainly not a strategy you want people to use. And I know also that, yeah, when things crash, it's hard to debug in the testing environment. But it's just logistically hard to give you a good way to debug it. We can't like easily give you a debugger for that environment. And I'd like to like give you address sanitizer output, but that's also difficult because I'd like need to remove the testing stuff from the output so you could figure out what's going on. But yeah, but I appreciate like specific suggestions about things we can do, and there's some here, like things we should have gotten a refresher on. And we could probably give a little more detail about some of the confusing test cases. Okay. And another issue is that there are some logistical problems with office hours late Tuesday, and the root cause is a TA missed the beginning of their office hours, but the queue wasn't closed. So I don't think that will recur, and we're sorry about that. Okay, so that's the end of my logistical stuff. Any non-anonymous feedback, questions, comments? Yeah.
What topics have we covered? Is it like up until this week, or?
Yeah, the exam will cover up until and including this week and this lecture and anything we don't get to and do on Tuesday. Yeah. And it includes anything in lecture, homeworks, reading, or labs. Just to be clear, yes.
I just wanted to say that the submission things actually useful and nice. So.
Okay. Some people like the having an auto grader, yeah, like that. So on to the topic for today. So we're going to talk about describing hardware, and so far we've done pictures. Here's a counter. We have a register labeled count. I'm going to represent registers with this little notch with a circle, with a square, sorry, rectangle with a little notch, which is a common notation for that. And I'll use these blue boxes to represent some combinatorial logic. I'm not going to tell you how it works. So this is one way we could represent pictures. And this is a way that some people develop real circuits. And there are even commercial tools for building circuits this way and then doing the process of turning them into a physical circuit somehow. But these aren't commonly used for processors. And the main reason is that it's pretty awkward to actually deal with drawing all the sorts of things you want to draw and then doing the things you want to do for like software, like version control and debugging. It's actually not so easy if you're just drawing pictures. It gets unwieldy. So people typically use a programming language that's typically text-based for designing circuits. And you've read about one in your textbook and our variant of it. And this often, in addition to letting you describe your circuit, abstracts away lots of details that you usually don't care about. Like, you can write arithmetic operations, and when you don't care, not worry about how that's going to be translated into the gates. Maybe at some point someone needs to figure that out, or maybe the software can do it for you if it's simple enough, but you can just write arithmetic operations and not worry about how that gets translated into gates or transistors. And in this course, we're never going to care about how arithmetic gets turned into gates. There's another course you should take if you want to know about that. You don't need to worry about building registers or memories. We're just going to say, I want a register, or I want a memory. That's typically how these tools will work. And someone later on will worry about, if they need to, about how to build that register or memory physically. And we'll also abstract away details like how to build muxes. So we'll have, you know, so we saw muxes in the pictures that Samira showed you. We'll have them as sort of an entity that we can just use. It's not going to be the case we're going to need to describe how a mux works with like bitwise operations. You could do that. That's an exercise that we had in lab. But we're not going to do that here. We're just going to say, I know what I want. I want a mux here with these inputs and these outputs. So in this course, we're going to use a tool which was developed by Luther Jakanovich, which is based on the hardware control language in our textbook, but slightly different. It's called HCL2D. It's linked off the course webpage on the top. There's something you can download and run on any Linux-like system, including the lab machines, which is our recommendation if you can't get it to run on your machine. So this tool lets you describe circuits. It notably is distorted, like the tool described in our textbook, because it assumes you're making a processor. So it's just not designed to deal with other types of circuits. There's no fundamental reason. It's just designed for this course. So we assume you're making a processor. In fact, a processor which looks very much like the one in our textbook. And there's some minor differences between it and the textbook's HCL. I'm just going to be giving the HCL to the examples here and not telling you what the textbook says. So let's start by taking a simple, yeah.
Sorry, before we get too far away from this, is this tool, is it all command line based, text based, or like?
Yes, in fact, I will be, it's all command line based. I will be showing you how to use it at some point in this lecture, yes.
When you come across something that's different from the textbook, can you point that out? Because if we read the textbook, it could get confusing.
So I believe in the readings we had the HCL to D documentation, I believe that it enumerates the differences, which is what you should check. I might not remember all of them, which is what I'm saying. The big one is that some names are different, and the built-in components that HCL to D provides are a little less complete, which gives you more freedom to build things. Okay, so here's a simple processor that does no ops. And I have an instruction memory here. You might say, why do we need that? Well, because HCL2D is designed for building processors, you always have to have an instruction memory. And you always have to supply it with an input. So that's why I drew that here. So we have an instruction memory which takes the current instruction, and we're just always going to assume it's a no-op. So we're going to add one, the length of a no-op to it, and set that to the new PC. So we have our PC register here. And we want to turn this into the text that in HCL2D to describe this circuit. So the first thing we're going to need is we're going to need to represent our program counter register, which I've labeled the PC, and I've labeled that because that's the name I'm going to use. So to do this, I need to declare a register. And in HCL2D, and this is not in the textbook, I believe, you can declare register banks. So a register bank is named with two letters, the first one lowercase, the second one uppercase, and can contain any number of registers. And for each of the registers, it has a name, a number of bits wide it is, and its initial value. The initial value is not optional. So the two letters that name the register bank are going to be prefixes when we access the register, which we'll see later. So the P, the lowercase, the first letter here, is the name of the signal that comes into the register. So it's going to start with a lowercase p in this case, because I put a p there. The F, the uppercase F, is the name of the signal which comes out of the register. And that's going to be, in addition to the name here, you'll see how we combine those two. So we then need to represent this combinatorial logic. And as I mentioned earlier, we're not going to deal with how that gets translated into gates. We're just going to write arithmetic and not worry about it. So I'm going to name the outgoing part of the register, which is with the capital letter, because that's the outgoing part, and then underscore and the name I gave it. So F underscore the PC is this outgoing wire here. Yes?
Are P and F arbitrary letters?
P and F are arbitrary letters.
Oh, so you could have picked like A and B.
Yes, and you could also have picked lowercase p and capital P. Oh. I didn't do that because it's easier to describe if they're different letters. Yes?
With like the P underscore the PC, is that automatically like something that the programming language understands because you named register PF like in that way, or did you have to?
So the question is P underscore the PC, is that understood because I have this register declaration? And yes. So when you write this register bank declaration, it creates these two signals, one called P underscore the PC and one called capital F underscore the PC.
That's
what?
The
yes. The upper, yeah.
So So because we're named, we're identifying registers like this, does it mean we're limited in the number of registers we have? I know it's
the... So the question is, are we limited in the number of registers we have? So today, I'm only going to show you register banks with one register, but you can add another line like VPC:64 to this. But you, yes, you are limited in the number of register banks you can have. In practice, being limited to 26 register banks is not going to be a problem. Yes, question?
Is the capital P in F the PC, is that a typo? Or is it
a typo? That is a typo, yes. Sorry. The case does actually need to match. Yeah, question? So the question is yes. Do we have to initialize the register? And you do. So this this equals zero is not optional. Yes.
So each register bank can contain only one register, or
it can contain any. So the question is, can each register bank contain only one register? No. So my examples today will only have one, but you could put as many as you like with other lines which look like this VPC:64.
And you're limited to 26 banks.
You're limited to, effectively, to limited to 26 banks. Right, actually, yeah. But, which won't be a problem at all. You're not going to get close to that. I promise. And you don't want to get close to that. Something is going to be very confusing to you if you do that. Okay. So this line represents connecting the input and output of this register we created to this combinatorial logic. And generally, statements that aren't declaring state elements are going to be this form of connection, where we say some wire input is equal to some output of something. So, another thing I mentioned, we always need an instruction memory, and the instruction memory is a built-in component. So I didn't write anything about it, it just exists. Because that's how HCLTD works, we always have an instruction memory. And you have to set it up. It has an input which is called lowercase pc, which is why I named the register the way I did. And that's the address to fetch. And like we discussed in lecture, this is a magic memory. So you set PC to a value, and then there's an output which gets the memory at that location in the same cycle. This is unlike a register, which is going to wait until the rising edge of the clock, till the next cycle, to store a new value. So we can set PC to F_VPC. It doesn't matter that we're using it twice. That is, using a value twice as an input, that is perfectly fine to do. And this says you should retrieve the memory address in PC from the instruction memory. And that will get output on a signal called I10 bytes. We just aren't using it. It exists, but we just don't have any reason to use it here. So there's one other component I didn't show you that we need, and that there's a built-in component called the stat register, which has a signal called stat. And this tells HCL2D when it's simulating our processor whether it needs to keep going. So I'll show you the signals for not keeping going, but for now, we're going to just set it to A-OK, which means keep going, keep executing, I'm not halting. Okay, so this is our simplest possible processor, basically. And this is our complete HCL file, modulo a typo. And we're going to need to run this. And I mentioned that the instruction memory is a mandatory component, so we need to supply some input to that, which means we need a program to load into memory. And that's going to be represented by a .yo file, like a .o file, but for y86, which we need to produce from some assembly. And with HCL2D, we provide an assembler, which is going to be called YAS, for y86 assembler, which will convert a y86 assembly file to a that .io file. And there's also a interpreter we will provide, which is good for comparing whatever processor you build to. So let's do our, okay. So I have unpacked, I have unpacked HCL2D as you download it, except I have a few extra files here I'm gonna use for the app. So the first thing you're gonna want to do when you download it is run make to actually build everything, including the assembler, the actual HCL2D tool, and so on. And then let's do the steps we need. So first, we're gonna take, we have our, I've pre-written our NoOps CPU here. So it's a .hcl file, and I want to compile it into a simulator. And the way I'm gonna do that is that I'm gonna run make, and I'm gonna specify the name of the simulator executable, which is gonna be the name of the HCL file with .hcl with replaced with .exe. So because the file that I wrote is nopcpu.hcl, I'm gonna make nopcpu.exe. And this is gonna build a simulator program for this processor. So this runs some commands to create nopcpu.exe, and we have some output here. So HCL2D tries to guess like roughly how complex your circuit is. That's just for your information. We're not going to use it. Also, I have some warnings that, oh, I'm not using some components that HCL2D build supports. In particular, I'm not using the data memory. I'm not using parts of a built-in register file. That's fine. We didn't care about them for what we're doing here. And this, as I said, creates an executable called nopcpu.exe. So I can run that, and it tells me, oh, to run this, you, it's nopcpu.exe, you can supply some options, and you provide a .io file, which is the program memory to live. And we'll look at these options a bit later. So we need a program memory to load. So we're gonna start with an assembly file, and I prepared one in this .ys file. It's a nice simple assembly file, contains a few nops. And we're gonna build this into a program memory image to load. And we're gonna do that by saying we want the .io file, nops.io. I'm gonna make that. And that just runs YAS to build it. And so that creates a nops.io file, which is in fact is a text file, so you can actually figure out what's going on. And the format of the file is that we have the memory address at which something is loaded, the hexadecimal values loaded, and then some comment on the side, which happens to be the original assembly code, but this stuff on the side isn't actually interpreted. It's just there to help you figure out what's going on. So our simulator can take this file, and we can run it by just passing it as an argument. So what do you people think is going to happen?
Nothing.
Nothing. What do you mean by nothing?
Because it's just running a few no operations.
So it's going to run a few NOP operations and then stop. Okay. Okay. So the question is, how is it? Isn't it just going to walk through them? Yeah.
Is it ever going to halt?
So the question is it ever going to halt? And that is a good prediction. So here we are running it, and it doesn't seem to be stopping. I'm going to press Control C. So you can see that we got some output here. And among this output is the values of the built-in register bank. We aren't using any of these, but after every cycle, the simulator says what the values of all the program registers are. It also says what the value of our register bank register is. So here it's telling us that that BPC, that register is set to hex 18D3. It also says that we set the PC wire, that which remembers the input to the instruction memory, to 18D3, what it was outputting in the, after this cycle. And that caused us to load this instruction. It helped, the simulator will decode the instruction for you, which makes it a lot easier to debug. We're actually loading, you know, the full 10 bytes. We just don't show that because we show it's relevant for implementing a processor in this class. So we loaded the halt instruction, and we didn't halt. And the reason we didn't halt is we didn't implement anything which would recognize a halt instruction. Okay, so let's look at what we need to do to implement a halt instruction. That we need to do something about this stat register. That we need to put a mux in front of the stat register, and not just always say, A-OK, keep going. We need to sometimes say, you should halt. I'm also going to use this other status code, INS, which is for invalid instruction, which will just halt our simulator in a different way. So we have this mux, and I need to somehow write that down in HCL2D. And I haven't shown you how to implement muxes. That should be brackets. There should be brackets. There should be braced, so braces around that zero there. We will show a real example, which will hopefully make things clearer. So there's something called a case expression in the book, which is implemented in HCL2D, where you specify an open square bracket, and then you have a list of possibilities with some condition, like x equals 5. If x equals 5, output 1. If x in, there should be braces around that 0. There's a set notation, which you can see in the HCL2D documentation. 0 or 6, output 2. If x is greater than 2, output 3. These are evaluated in order. So first what we do is see if x equals 5, then we output 1. If, say, x is 3, we're going to go down to x greater than 2. If x equals 5, we're going to stop at this first step. These are evaluated in order, and the result is whichever expression has the condition be true first, the corresponding value after the colon.
So if none of them are true.
So if none of them are true, there is a default. But generally, I would recommend doing something like this, like one colon and a default value. I think the default is 0. I'm not sure. I'd have to look it up. Yes?
So in the quiz, the pre-quiz of the set was represented with curly brackets. Is that?
That's what it should be, yeah. Sorry.
It should be
this is a me not using LaTeX correctly issue, which I will correct when I post these slides later today. So we have this extract opcode step here. So we need to know how to take the output of our instruction memory, which is 10 bytes, because it's the whole largest instruction we might care about, and get the opcode out of it. So we need some way of extracting some part of that value. And HCL2D has a special syntax for this. So if you want to extract bits 2 through 9, where 2 inclusive, 9 exclusive, so bits 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 of a value, you can use this syntax. The least significant bit is bit 0. This is a point of confusion. So i10 bytes is conceptually an 80-bit integer loaded from memory in little endian format. The first byte is the least significant byte. The first bit with that bit numbering we talked about is the least significant bit of that first byte. But in our instruction encoding, we have opcode fn, like so, where this is the first byte as written in hex. So the fn is the least significant part of that. And the opcode part is the most significant part. This means that if you want to extract the opcode, what the book calls the I-code, we want to extract bits 4 through 8, not 0 through 4. And there's going to be a similar issue when you're thinking about RA and RB. So what we can do with that is we can write our mux here. So we set stat to be one of these choices. So if the opcode part of I10 bytes, the output of the instruction memory is NOP, which is, this is a constant, which is just equal to the value of I code that's NOP, then A-OK. If it's HALT, then HALT. Otherwise, we default to invalid instruction. Yes?
So, is the case like for every other byte as well, where the first bit is going to be the least significant bit?
Yes. So the question is it the case for every other byte that the first bit is the least significant bit? So, for example, for the second byte, which might contain RA and RB, RB is in the least significant part of that byte. So bit 8 is the least significant bit of RB in instructions that have registers. It is not a bit of RA. Yes? Stat INS is a constant which tells the simulator invalid instruction. The only difference between it and HALT is that's going to exit with a different message. Yes?
Where are you declaring the values of NOP and HALT?
So there's a question, where am I declaring these values NOP and HALT and all that? That's a good question. So let's see if I can. So in our HCL2D write-up, we have this big block of stuff here, and this is everything that's defined for you. And among that is constants for all the instructions and for all the condition code specifiers and things like that. So I could have written if it equals 1, but instead, these constants defined for me, it's much more readable to use it. Yes?
So little Indian, the bytes are reversed. So are you now reversing the bits as well?
So the question is, in little Indian, the bytes are reversed. No, they aren't. You have to choose how you interpret the bytes. And neither choice is more natural than the other. The only reason we find it reversed is that the way we write numbers in English is basically big endian. But it's not the case that one choice is better than the other. So, but to be consistent, we're numbering bits, so the least significant bit is lowest. And we're numbering bytes, so the least significant byte is lowest. So I have this HCL2D program, and it seems awfully inconvenient to be typing I10 bytes, bracket 4.8, maybe error prone, maybe I'll get confused about what part of the instruction I want. It would be nice to have another name for that. And we have a mechanism in HCL2D for having a shortcut for that. And that's something called wires. This is a different name than what's in the book. So I can declare a wire, which is just a named value which can hold a signal, like this. So I have a wire I call iCode, and I'm saying it's 4 bits wide. And I have a wire called valp, which I'm saying is 64 bits wide. And I can assign iCode to be equal to that part of that I10 bytes at 4.8. And then I don't have to type I10 bytes 4.8 over and over again. And if we go back to, so if we look at this NOOP jump CPU, so I have that implementation here. That's later. The NOOP HALT CPU, I have my implementation here. So I can build that. And correct the same typo that I had in my slides. How about that? The same typo I had twice in my slides. Yep, twice. Good work. And then I can run it on the same nops I saw earlier. And it actually finishes. And note that when it's done, it tells me, oh, I ran for 6 cycles. And I can compare that tool running the reference implementation, which we mentioned was YIS, on nops.yo, and it says, oh, it took 6 steps and then halted. YIS for Y86 interpreter. Yes?
What is the time used field?
The time, so the question is, what's the time used field? This is a rough estimate based on the complexity of the circuit, complexity of the operations you're doing, how long it might take. It's very approximate, and you should not, and we're not going to be using it, but it's to give you an idea of what estimated complexity. No, it's like probably, like, if you, so the question is it in milliseconds? It's not really in any real units, but it's probably like more closely approximated by like thinking about picoseconds or something like that. So that was our that. So let's now implement something more interesting, which is alluded to. Let's add jump support. So to add jump, I'm going to need to extract the destination from the jump instructions. I'm only going to implement unconditional jumps here. And then I'm going to need to choose what the next valp is. Or I'm using valp, which is not the name of the book, but choose what the next program counter is, which I have a wire for, set the program counter to it, and next program counter to it. And I need to implement different logic for step, because now the JFX instruction is one I understand when I shouldn't halt on, I should keep going. So the additional things I needed is I need to extract the destination and actually use it. So we can do our same procedure of and run this CPU. And I'm going to show, now that we have a more interesting example, some other features of HCLTD that will be helpful to you when you're actually trying to figure out what your processor is doing. Let's start out by building HCLTD. This file, this is our no-op jump CPU. And we also need an assembly file for it. We don't probably just don't want to use the one which is only nops, because we have things other than nops here. So I have an assembly file prepared with some jumps. This is actually not completely trivial. So I'm going to turn that into a .yo file. And you'll note that our assembler figured out how to put the address of these labels in the instruction for us. And we have a program with variable length instructions that we can actually use with our processor. So let's run our processor on this file. Okay. So we see, okay, it takes 7 cycles. We end up at address. We end up with 0 being the next thing to load on the PC, but yeah, just after loading a halt. So everything looks fine. And we can compare this, again, to what happens when I run it with the reference version, the YIS, the interpreter written by our textbook authors. So I can say, what do you do on this file? And it says, oh, it takes 7 steps. And the last PC we load is 1E. So it looks like we implemented things correctly. So if you remember earlier, I showed you what happens when I just type not jump CPU.exe and say, and it gives me some options. So let's look at these options. So one option I have is I can time out after some small number of steps. So I can say, I only want to run the CPU for 2 cycles. In which case it will load that jump, it's ready to execute the next instruction, and stops. Another option is that there's an interactive mode. So let's look at what that does. So this starts and says, oh, press enter to continue. And when I press enter, it runs 1 second. So it loads the first instruction, which is an op, sets the PC, finishing the next rising edge of the clock, preparing for the next rising edge of the clock, and now we're ready for the next cycle. Yes?
What's the used memory part?
So the used memory, so what is this used memory output? So we have output for the register file and for what's in memory. So we're only showing the parts of memory which aren't zeros. All parts of memory that aren't specified default to zero. And this shows what's exactly in memory. So address, so hex 1, 6 is zero. You can see by going to 6 for the last digit and 1 for the first digit. And this shows you what memory currently is. So if we change memory, this will change. And so I can keep going and look at what happens a cycle at a time until things finish. Yes?
So I think the PC jumped from 1 to 1.3
the first time we ran 1 cycle. Why did the PC jump from 1, so it's 1 now, to 1.3? So the reason is the instruction we loaded was jump to 0x13, and we actually implemented that correctly. We actually extracted the 1.3 here from the instruction and set it to the new PC. So the other mode, other option we see, is that there's minus D. So let's look at what that does. So this gives a little extra output. We have, for each cycle, we not only get to learn what instruction is loaded, but we also see every signal that gets set. So I set the PC to 0x1e, I set the I code to 0, I set the destination to 0, LP to 0, the PC to 0, and stat to 2. So it's showing every step we go through during that cycle. Yes?
Can you do like two of these at the same time, like the bug and one and something?
So the question is, can we do two of them at the same time? So let's try that. So minus D and minus I. Well, looks like we can. So if I press enter, it just does one cycle, much more handy, so I can actually read the output from each cycle before I move on. Or I could save the output to a file and go back, maybe. But I can see everything which goes on, and here something more interesting is happening. We're setting iCode to 1 because we loaded the NOOP. We also get a value for dest, which we aren't going to use, which is good because it's not part of the instruction. Just when it's what's in memory after it, which we loaded anyways. And we set valp, we compute the input to the program counter register. And we set stat to 1, which happens to be the AOK code. So this is probably what most of you will be doing when something weird goes on in your processor to figure out what is actually happening. This is how you get output for everything which is happening. You could try to work from just this stuff, but probably not. So there's another option, which is dash Q. So let's look at what dash Q does. So that just says what happens at the end. So this is handy if you want to compare to YIS, so the reference implementation, because it just shows you the finishing state, and that's what tools YIS does. It just shows you how things ended up. But it's a lot less useful for knowing anything which happened in between. So any questions about any of these HCL to D features? Okay, so that's our brief tutorial on HCL to D. Let me show that. Okay, so we showed you one built-in component in HCL to D, which was the instruction memory, and some other features. So we showed you register banks, we showed you wires, and we talked about the stat register and a little about the instruction memory. As you can see from that output, there's also a built-in register file that HCL2D has implemented for you, RAX, RBX, and so on. You don't have to write them yourself. In fact, you shouldn't, you will not do well on assignments if you write them yourself, because our grading scripts will assume that you're using the built-in one. And we also supply a data memory. So I'm going to talk about what the interfaces for each of these are exactly are like. So I mentioned we saw register banks before. We have an input letter and an output letter. The input letter is lowercase, and there's input signals, and you can specify multiple registers like this. And they don't even have to be the same width. You'll see we're using this notation because it actually corresponds to something our textbook will do later on when we talk about pipelining, even though for now it seems really confusing to have the input and output letter. Question? Yes, you probably should correct this slide to not have two examples of the same signal. Okay. So the other thing we talked about is wires, and just applies to both wires that you define and anything which can accept or produce a signal basically creates a wire. So creating a register bank creates a wires for the inputs and outputs, which act basically the same as one you define, except maybe its output is being used somewhere, or maybe its input is already set without you writing anything. But otherwise, they act the same. You can use them in expressions in the same way, and so on. So you can assign to a wire once, and you can use the wire's value multiple times. An assignment basically means connecting the output of a wire to the input to another wire. A wire can't have two inputs. Yes?
When you say that you can only use a wire once, you mean?
You can only set the value of a wire once.
Per cycle.
Yeah, so, and everything in your HCLTD happens every cycle, because it is the equivalent of the pictures we've shown you. Like, it's how things are wired up is how you should think about it. In particular, just like wiring things up physically, it doesn't matter what order you decide to connect the wires in, it only matters if they're connected or not. This means that it doesn't matter if I use valp before I write the connection to valp, which determines what its value is. That is perfectly legal. HCL2D will execute both of these in the exact same way. This is a point of confusion for a lot of people. So everything that you specify happens in every cycle. And HCL2D will figure out it's as if things are wired up that way, and it will just flow through the circuit. Yes?
But you do need to instantiate things like wire, register before, or not?
So the question is, do we need to instantiate things?
The first three lines, the order of those.
Matches. You need to, I believe the order of, yeah. I believe you might need to declare the wire beforehand and the register. I'm not sure, actually. If it doesn't work, it's going to be an error. It's not going to do something weird. Yeah. Sure. Question?
So, in our previous example where we used dest for the jump, does that mean we need to declare it as a wire
I'm not sure what the rules are exactly on when you need to declare it. I think you need to declare it early, beforehand. But you'll get an error if that's a problem. This confuses people, because people often assume that if I put the assignment down here, it does something different. And neither of them gives an error, but they're both the same. Everything happens in one cycle. The HCLTD simulator will figure out the order in which values propagate, without paying attention to what order you wrote them in. Yes, question.
On an exam or something, would we give code and be asked, what does this do, or something
That is possible, yes. The question is, could you be asked, what does this do? Yes, we could do that. Yeah?
So we can also put wire I code for something later on afterwards, right?
Yes. The question is, can you put the wire I code for later on? Yeah. I'm just not sure whether you can put it after its use. And I wouldn't recommend it if you could. That seems very confusing. This at least kind of makes sense, because I'm saying there's a valp, I'm going to figure it out at some point, but not even declaring it seems confusing.
Are there any particular guidelines of style that you
would want us to follow when doing
the question is, are there any particular guidelines of style? I don't think we have much in particular. I mean, beyond normal style things that apply to languages you already use. You will probably find it helpful to split up things you're doing by stage. That's one of the reasons we talk about those stages, but it's not necessary. You might find other ways of organizing things. Okay, so the order doesn't matter. Either the wire is connected to something or it isn't. It's not connected at any particular time. That's all that matters. So the other thing is that wires have widths. You cannot assign wires with different widths. If you want to do this, you need to select the bits you want. Yeah, question? It's inclusive for the first value, exclusive for the second, which is why this is a 32-bit selection and not a 33-bit one. Yeah, question?
Can the wire width be arbitrary?
The question is, can the wire width be arbitrary? Yes, there might be some limit. You shouldn't need anything wider than 80 bits.
Like powers of twos or something like that?
They do not have to be powers of two or anything like that. Yeah.
So that's how we should have implemented the first box we did, where it just checks the opcode. You could have just done it with only a certain wire.
So the example I gave earlier of with the name wires, it does exactly that. We make a wire with four, which is the size of an opcode, and we extract that part of the output of the instruction memory into that named wire, so we don't have to keep typing i10 bytes, open brace, and so on. So, mentioned that we have our stat register. So as I said earlier, our stat register is how we control whether the simulator keeps going. So it's going to check if you set it to A-OK, and it's going to keep going. There are other values. You can see the list of constants on the HCL2D webpage that are possible stat values, which signal other things. Generally, everything but A-OK will keep the simulator from going and stop it. And you must set it, otherwise we don't know whether to keep going or not, and HCL2D will give you an error saying, you didn't set stat, I don't know what to do. Yeah, question?
You said that your condition is if not halt, then continue, instead of if no option, okay, if jump out.
So the question is, can you set the condition as if not halt, then continue? So, we could, so you could do something like stat equals iCode doesn't equal halt stat A-OK, otherwise stat halt. So absolutely. So I'm missing some declarations here, obviously, but that's a way you could do that. Yeah, question?
I was going to ask about the errors.
Errors?
Yeah, because can't you, some of the stat register things that you can do are stat error detection, right? Like the INF spell word instruction.
So let's look at what the errors look like. So let's set the stat to stat INS. This is my minimal HCL file. And we'll make test.exe, nops.yo. So when we set an error, we got something like this. That's the only difference is that it halts in a different way. So we also had an instruction memory, and as we saw, the instruction memory has an input wire, which is called PC, which takes an address, a 64-bit address. And in the same cycle, it outputs on this output wire, which is called i10 bytes, to remind you that it's a 10-byte wide wire with the instruction, which is the value of the instruction. And note that this is always 10 byte wide. What if you don't need all 10 bytes? Don't use them. We're still going to read them. It's not the case that you can like cycle back to the instruction memory and tell it how many bytes you want to give it. That's also not the case in a real processor. Well, not usually the case in a real single cycle processor, that would not be the case. Okay. So we also have a built-in register file. So you could implement a register file with register banks. This is possible, but you will not have to do that. Instead, we will give you something which works like the register file we talked about in class. Namely, there are going to be some register number inputs. And they're called very similar names to what you saw Samir use in those diagrams. There's reg underscore source A, reg underscore source B. For the source registers, reg underscore destem and reg underscore desti for the destination registers. These are 4-bit wires because they are register numbers. And there are 15 registers, so that needs 4 bits. So as you saw when we looked at Y86 64 instruction set, they got rid of R15, which means that there's some 15th register number. And that's used to signal don't read or write anything. So if you ask to read from this register, the register file that's implemented built in will always give 0. If you ask to write to this register, it will always do nothing. It will take in an input, but it won't do anything with it. So in addition to our register numbers, we also have 2 register value inputs corresponding to the 2 destination registers, so reg input E and reg input M. These are 64 bits wide, like you expect for a value in our processor. And we have 2 outputs, which are the values corresponding to source A and source B. So the inputs will be applied at the next clock cycle. So we'll sample them and they'll change the register starting with the next clock cycle. The outputs will occur in the same clock cycle that you set source A or source B, just like the instruction memory and its PC to I10 bytes. Yes?
Can you explain how this is different from the P and F input and output?
So the question is, how is this different from just a register bank, just defining a register bank?
Are these like the built-in like?
This is the built-in register file, and notably, we have register numbers, which is not something you could ever do with those register banks I showed you. If you wanted to do that with the register banks I showed you, you'd like need a mux.
So these register files are referring to the 0x0 through 0xE registers?
Yeah, the registers RAX, RBX, and so on. Right. These are our program registers. And they're the ones that when you saw the HCL to D output, these registers that are output here are the ones that are in this built-in register file. Any questions about these? So, for example, if I'm using this register file, I would extract RA and RB, which are in not the places you're guessing, because remember, least significant bits, which is written second when we're writing a byte. So RA is bytes 12 through 6, RB is bytes 8 through 12. So if I'm implementing, say, an add instruction, which is what this example is, I would set source A to RA from the instruction, source B to RB, and then my input to the register file is the sum of the 2 outputs, and my destination is RB. Yeah, question? So the question is, can I give the difference between these register numbers and these? So the number says whether I want RAX, RBX, RSP, or so on. The value is the actual thing that's in that register or thing I want to put in that register, depending on whether it's an input or an output. Yes?
Can you go back to the other slide where like you had it written out?
Yeah.
So when you say like reg output A, it knows that you're looking for the output of source A, which is RA?
Yeah, so the question is, reg output A, it knows that that means source A, and yes. So these are all built in. You don't get to choose the names, and they exist. If you just use the name of the input, the output will exist. So you remember earlier when we built something with HCLTD, we got a warning message that we didn't specify source A, disabling read port A. So that's telling us I didn't generate reg output A because you didn't specify source A. But if you specify it, it will generate that output and it will be available to you. Yeah, question?
Did you at some point have to specify reg destination E as like the same as the source B so that it also will be input?
So the question is, did I have to specify destination E as the same as B? Yes, and that's what this line here does. Reg dest E is RB, the same as reg source B.
And it'll know to put the input into that?
Yeah, because this input E is the corresponds to the number in dest E. And remember that the order in which I assign things doesn't matter. I could have assigned dest E all the way up here. That would have been fine. I just wrote it in the order of the stages here. So I have PC update, decode, execute, write back, so on, just for means, which is the sort of organization I'd recommend. Yeah?
So you said that dest E is RB, and you kind of like go one cycle. Do you need to clear that?
So the question is, I set dest E to RB. Do I need to clear that? So on the next cycle, the answer is no, because RB is going to have a different value in the next cycle. Every cycle, all the signals are computed again from the state elements. And what matters for what's stored in the register is what was the state at the end of that cycle that determines what gets stored when the cycle finishes. Same for the data memory, which we'll talk about in a bit. Yeah.
This might be outside the scope of what we're doing now, but just kind of kind of curious to know the whole idea of the compiler just knows which one or which of these codes to do first, or like what happens.
So the question is, how does the simulator actually work? So it's conceptually the same way that the circuit works, that its signals flow from the inputs and it just looks for where they keep going. So it just propagates them down. So if you know about graphs, it's a graph search. This is an actual application of direct depth-first search. You didn't think it was useful? Here's one. Yeah.
So would this like decode right here? This is only for like an add instruction, right? So
yeah.
You would put this in like if this is an add instruction, do this.
So the question is, this decodes only for an add? So yes and no. Okay. These first parts of the code here, that is useful all the time. I would probably have that no matter what instruction I'm running. But yeah, this part, that would need to be controlled by a MUX in the real processor. And you saw when Samira showed the picture of the processor, we had this MUX in front of the source A input, and a MUX in front of the source B input, which we represent as a case expression, those square brackets, and you'd have that in a more complete processor.
So like that whole execute down then? Because you don't want to set the E.
Yeah, so also input E, that's also controlled by a MUX. You remember there was, it either came from the ALU or the memory. So we'd also have a case expression for that. To keep things fitting on one slide, I didn't show that here. Okay. So here's a register file picture. You can think about what works. So note that I didn't specify all the values in the register file. That's fine. They just have sensible defaults. So the register number inputs default to none, which means that it doesn't matter. I don't have an input for destem. It just defaults to the none input, meaning don't write to a register, which is good, because if it defaulted to something like zero, then we'd be writing to RAX all the time, which would be bad. But I note this because this is a mistake you will probably make, is not setting it to reg none when you actually have to set it to a value sometimes. Okay. So another thing our processor has is a data memory. So there's a built-in data memory, and it takes roughly the inputs we discussed, that Samira discussed. So we have an input address, which is called mem_adder. And this is a magic memory, like the instruction memory. So if we specify an address in the same cycle, we get the output value. It also takes an input value. And we don't always want to write to memory. And it doesn't really make sense to read and write from memory at the same time. So we have some control signals to decide which we do. So these are 1-bit wires. One is called memReadBit. If it's set, we read. If it's not, we don't. One is called memWriteBit. If it's set, we write. If it's not, we don't. If you set both of these to 1, that's a problem. Don't do that. If you set both of these to 0, that's fine. You don't need to access memory. So for example, if I want to read from this memory address, this would be, sorry, if I want to write to this memory address, I would do that. And I did this wrong. So yeah. So those slides are wrong, but we can, the slides are reversed, memory bit and write bit. So the idea is that you will set memory bit based on what the instruction is. You're like, if I code is MR move queue, I want to read from memory, and so on. And most of the time, they'll be 0. Because most of our instructions are register to register. Okay. So the big differences from the book, just to help people get the right framing, is that we have wires and not bools or ints. So we don't have any of those special types in the book. Everything is a wire. The book uses some fixed names, and in the book's implementation, they had some restrictions on what, on like defining new wires and things like that. We don't have that. So the book might imply that you can't like make up names. You can make up wire names all you want. That's fine. I think the book also gave students an implementation which had a built-in ALU component. You're going to have to write your own. It's not actually hard. Basically, what an ALU is that you have a big case expression, which is going to turn into a MUX with some arithmetic stuff behind it. Yes?
A MUX is just something that takes in multiple inputs in part one and returns a different input, right?
So the question is, a MUX is something which just takes multiple inputs and returns one of them? Yes, that is exactly what a MUX is. And these case expressions correspond exactly to a MUX and the logic for deciding what its selector input is and what its inputs are. Just a convenient way of specifying all that together rather than giving you a MUX component and then having you figure out how to do the bit manipulation to set the input selector wire, which would be just very annoying and not worth your time. Okay, so another thing is that because of the way our textbook's HCL works, that they have some design choices where they have less choice. So for example, in our textbook, they always put the memory to the M port of the register file. That's probably less confusing to do, but there's no thing requiring you to do that. We're not going to check. We want your processor to work and work in the correct number of cycles, like it should be a single cycle processor if we ask for one, not a multi-cycle one. But we want it to work and do the same thing the simulator does. We don't care what the internals look like so much. And like, for example, in our textbook, RSP plus or minus 8 uses the normal ALU. You don't, like, that would probably be the easiest thing to do on a real processor, but we're not going to check that you're doing that. We don't care if you, like, have a separate adder conceptually for doing that. You just need to implement the instruction so it changes memory and registers in the right way in the right amount of time. You have more design choices than the textbook might suggest because we don't have limitations in our tool. Okay. So I finished up on time. So that's HCL to D. So big things to remember is that we have these wires that you assign values to, which is like connecting the wire. We have an input syntax for MUXes, syntax for register banks, and we have all this fixed functionality for register banks and memories.